From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Nick Hornby. His books High Fidelity, Fever Pitch, and About a Boy were adapted into films. His new novel, A Long Way Down, tells the story of four strangers who have gone to the rooftop of a 15-story building with the intention of jumping to their deaths. But meeting each other on the rooftop distracts them from their ultimate goal. As is typical of Hornby's novels, the new one is filled with perceptions about relationships, desires, frustrations, and popular culture. Also, now that the Michael Jackson trial is over, our critic-at-large John Powers considers how Jackson's life reflects popular American obsessions, and film critic David Edelstein reviews Batman Begins. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the British writer Nick Hornby. His first novel, High Fidelity, made him a favorite of rock and roll loving readers. It was adapted into a film starring John Cusack. High Fidelity was about the owner of a used record store who defines himself by his taste in music, movies, and books, and judges other people by theirs. Hornby's memoir, Fever Pitch, and his novel about a boy were also adapted into films. Hornby's new novel, A Long Way Down, tells the stories of four people who have decided to end their lives on New Year's Eve by jumping off the roof of a building in London that's well known as a destination for jumpers. But when these four strangers run into each other on the roof, instead of jumping, they end up talking, and in doing so, distract themselves from their plans. They agree to temporarily postpone their suicides, and in the meantime, this quite disparate group becomes enmeshed in each other's lives. The novel is told from the alternating points of view of the four characters. Nick Hornby, welcome back to Fresh Air. One of the characters in your novel who gets to the roof and intends on committing suicide is surprised to find that there are three other people already there with the same intention. And he looks at them and he thinks, suicide wasn't invented for people like this. It was invented for people like Virginia Woolf and Nick Drake and me. Suicide was supposed to be cool. So obviously you've thought about the whole romance surrounding suicide in popular culture. Did you want your novel to kind of have a conversation with other books and movies and poetry and popular culture about suicide?
Yes, in part. I mean, it's very much, I think, in our culture, and it is something that is romanticized by a certain section of a kind of hip young population. But there are all kinds of books and movies mentioned in A Long Way Down. And JJ, the musician, he is somebody who buys into that myth. But one of the things I wanted to do was point out at the same time the kind of banality of it as well.
Yes, and another thing I like about that quote there is it shows even if you think you're on the verge of suicide, you can still be very snobbish about other people and about popular culture.
Well, yeah, one of the things that kind of was interesting me in writing the book was that, you know, of course, life goes on until it stops, and you're going to have the same attitudes, and you're going to have, you know, songs that you're thinking about, people you're thinking about, bus tickets in your pocket. The detritus of life is carried right to the very end if you're going to cut it off like that.
What about the reality of suicide, as opposed to like the pop culture mystique around it? Do you have friends or family who have ever tried or succeeded at suicide?
Well, I lost a friend when I was quite young, when 21, 22, around about then. That was the most shocking loss of that kind that I've experienced.
Were you surprised?
He was one of those guys. He had scars on his wrists from a previous attempt, and I suppose we all thought that it was something he'd outgrown. But there was no sign of it as far as we knew prior to it happening, so I was surprised.
How did he do it?
He did the rubber hose and the exhaust pipe.
Which strikes me as a relatively painless way to go, not that I've ever experienced it, but the characters in your novel who plan to take their lives, plan to jump off the roof of a high rise. And that always seems to me like one of the most horrible ways of doing it. I mean, I think, you know, pills, a gun, gas, less painful. You know, jumping off a high roof always seems to me like the most self-punishing, or one of the most self-punishing forms of suicide, because there's not only that sense of impact, there's also that fear I think you would have that on the way down you would have all the anxiety thinking about that moment of impact, and there'd be that those extra few seconds where you could entertain doubt.
Well, one of the most remarkable things I read when I was preparing for this book was a magazine article in the New Yorker about people who jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. And I do quote this line in the book, an interview with a survivor, someone who'd hit the water but survived. And he said that that he realized very quickly after jumping that there was only one thing wrong with his life, and that was that he just jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge.
Huh. So why did you choose, why do these characters choose, you know, suicide by jumping off a roof? Or entertain the idea of suicide by jumping off a roof?
Well, I have to say, and I try and be practical and pragmatic wherever possible, rather than talk about artistic myths, but I have to say that the idea wouldn't have worked very well if they'd sat in their own cars and taken pills. I wanted them to meet each other, and, you know, I wanted them to be in a place where people killed themselves. But there was also the sense, yes, it's a very self-hating thing to do, I think, and at least three of the characters are in a very self-loathing state of mind. I didn't want to deal with clinical depression. I wanted to deal with what you might call circumstantial depression.
Why?
I think that there are some topics to write about that are very flat, and I think that clinical depression is one of them. It's not the same thing as saying that they're not important or that they don't have meaning, but they don't necessarily have a kind of narrative texture that you might want to write about. And I felt that was true of clinical depression. And I like the idea when I was thinking about it that if you're talking about circumstance, then every single character is going to have some kind of a dramatic story, which, of course, is something that you're looking for if you write.
And they all feel that logically this is a sensible thing to do. Like one of them has even made lists.
Pros and cons.
Yeah, pros and cons of committing suicide, which is very Nick Hornby, of course, to have a list. But they're convinced that, you know, that they're being rational and this is a rational thing to do.
They feel compelled by the force of their own logic that for one reason or another, life is actually over for them, and all they have to do is kind of put the seal on that.
Why did you choose suicide in the first place? Why examine people's lives who are on the verge of ending their lives?
Well, there are various answers to that. One of the things is that with my books, I want to try and go as dark as I can and as funny as I can within a domestic context, because I know that my characters are never actually going to do that anything that extreme in terms of the big picture. I don't think they're ever going to go to war. I can't imagine writing about history. So I'm stuck with people in the here and now. And if you want to push things on in writing about that, then obviously I'm looking for situations where people are in extremis. And, you know, it is something that is among us, that people want to take their own lives or feel like taking their own lives, you know, probably within a few hundred yards of where we're sitting now.
One of the characters in the book wants to kill himself because he always wanted to be a rock star and his band fell apart and he doesn't think he's going to make it. And that's a character that anybody who's read you knows that you would be familiar with. Another character has like a morning TV show in England and he's been disgraced because he slept with a 15-year-old and it's pop enough, people would kind of get your connection to it. There's a character who is very, very unlike you, and unlike the kind of characters you've written up before, although there's one connection. And she's a single mother of an autistic son. And your fans and readers know.
I don't think she is, the son is autistic, but is extremely disabled in the book. Sorry,
oh,
Justin.
Okay. I guess I've been reading that wrong. I've been projecting my knowledge of you onto her.
Yeah.
How would you describe her son?
I'd say extremely disabled, but it's left vague in the book.
Okay. Well, you do have a son who is autistic.
Yeah.
And but she is in so much unlike you. Let me first have you read a little bit of her story about why she plans on taking her life. One of the ways, I should say before you read this, one of the ways that she's not like you and not like what you usually write about is she's not ironic. And she's not into popular culture. She wants to kill herself because her son has been such a burden. Why don't you read this passage?
Sure. I only ever had intercourse with one man. And I only had intercourse with that one man once. And the one time in my entire life I had intercourse produced Matty. What are the chances, eh? One in a million? One in 10 million? I don't know. But of course, even 1 in 10 million means there are a lot of women like me in the world. That's not what you think of when you think of 1 in 10 million. You don't think that's a lot of people. What I've come to realise over the years is that we're less protected from bad luck than you could possibly imagine. Because though it doesn't seem fair, having intercourse only the once and ending up with a child who can't walk or talk or even recognise me, well, fairness doesn't really have much to do with it, does it? You only have to have intercourse the once to produce a child, any child. There are no laws that say you can only have a child like Matty if you're married, or if you have lots of other children, or if you sleep with lots of different men. There are no laws like that, even though you and I might think there should be. And once you have a child like Matty, you can't help but feel, well, that's it. That's all my bad luck, a whole lifetime's worth in one bundle. But I'm not sure luck works like that. Matty wouldn't stop me from getting breast cancer or from being mugged. You'd think he should, but he can't. In a way, I'm glad I never had another child, a normal one. I'd have needed more guarantees from God than he could have provided.
That's Nick Hornby reading an excerpt of his new novel, A Long Way Down.
It's got jokes in it as well.
Yes. Can you talk a little bit about the tone of Maureen? And I should mention here that when someone uses an expletive in talking to her, and this is her narrative, you know, she censors it.
She can't bring herself to repeat.
It's like F dash.
Yes, yes.
So, and I think it's, you're very respectful for her, to her in that sense.
Well, I mean, I think in some ways she's the soul of the book because, I mean, she's absolutely not the author of her own misfortune, even though her religious beliefs mean that sometimes she thinks she is. But you're right that... my characters typically, I guess, tend to be pretty tuned in to what's going on. And one of the reasons she's up on the roof, in fact, is because she's been tuned out. I mean, she really hasn't lived a life for these 20 years that she's bringing up the child. So technically, she provided more of a challenge, perhaps, because there was an absence where a life should be, and she's done nothing, whereas all the others have done something.
My guest is Nick Hornby. His new novel is called A Long Way Down. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nick Hornby. His new novel, A Long Way Down, is about four people who meet each other on the way to their own suicides. One of the characters, Maureen, has a severely disabled son. Hornby has a son who has autism. As a father, was it difficult for you to even entertain the idea that somebody's life would be so burdened by a disabled son that she'd want to take her own life?
No, it's not as much of a stretch, unfortunately, as you'd imagine. It's tough, and I think any parent of an autistic child or of a very disabled child has had some long dark nights of the soul during the child's upbringing. So I knew that I had the empathy for the character to embark on this. It's, you know, she's obviously not me, and her kid isn't my kid, but through having my kid, I've kind of entered into a world that I didn't really know very much about before.
Did you meet people like Maureen who were unable to cope with their children's problems?
There are a lot of people who can't cope, yeah. One of the things that interested me actually about writing Maureen was that I think that a lot of people might respond to her in the same way that the characters respond. I mean, a lot of readers might respond, which is, I absolutely understand why you would want to do this, why you would want to jump, and please be my guest, don't let us stop you. And all the time I was conscious of the fact that I could kind of almost play a trick on the reader because it required very small readjustments in her life to make her life tolerable. Whereas the other characters whose problems are not so severe, I think maybe those problems are more intractable.
She's not a character who defines her life by popular culture, unlike a lot of your characters. And there's an interesting detail in there. She has posters on her walls of, you know, pop stars and stuff, but they don't reflect an actor's. They don't reflect her taste. They reflect the taste that she thinks her son would have if her son was capable of comprehending or responding to movies and music. How did you come up with that? It's an interesting detail.
Well, I think, again, it's something that you might find yourself thinking about, because there comes a point, if you do have a severely disabled child, where they're given lots of kit when they're born and when they're toddlers, and it's got pictures of dogs on and this and that and the other. And then it kind of, they reach a point where a normal kid might be exercising his or her own taste. So you start to think as a parent, well, is it appropriate now if I start to choose things for my 5-year-old or my 6-year-old, you know, clothes to wear, pictures to put up on the wall? Because, you know, babies, we all make the same decisions equally because they are not capable of expressing anything. So it really came from that, you know, would you do it for a teenager? Would you just keep going? And as Maureen says, you know, he wouldn't understand if he had Gap on his shirt, or I don't even know if he recognises colours. So any decision that you make is going to be made on his behalf. And she sort of takes it to one step further by putting football players and what have you up on the wall.
Would you dress your son in a T-shirt that had, you know, that was like, you know, a music T-shirt or a movie T-shirt or anything like that? Because it would be reflecting tastes that he didn't really have on his own.
I think I probably would, on the same basis that I don't know how to reflect his tastes unless I run around looking for a very large T-shirt of a very childish video character. So there comes a point where you have to make these decisions. I live right by a football stadium, and quite often parents give kids stuff that's been bought from the gift shop in the stadium. So he tends to wear a lot of stuff connected with the football team. And, you know, I don't know.
Let me ask you about other characters in your novel besides Maureen. What I'd like to do is run through the characters quickly and just ask you to tell us how these characters relate most to you.
Okay.
Okay. So let's start with Martin, who has a morning TV show, and he's been disgraced because he's slept with a 15-year-old and he's kind of lost his wife and kids. He's kind of sacrificed his family by doing that. What do you relate to about that?
Well, there's something that I'm actually interested in, which is an increasing tendency in our society to glamorize people who have no talent. And this seems to be a new situation. I mean, I was thinking actually that, you know, a couple of these characters at least couldn't have existed 50 years ago, and Martin is one of them. And once you're in this situation where you're famous for having no talent whatsoever, what inner resources do you have to cope with anything that might happen to you? Or are you just a bubble? And my personal relationship, I suppose, is that over the last few years, I've had my own very, very minor experience of very, very minor celebrity. And it's a weird world. And it does mess with your head a bit. So there were things in there that I was wanting to explore a bit.
Then there's Jess, and she's, what, about 18?
Yeah.
And she's really out of control. She has a terrible temper. She's very difficult to be around. She's very rude and insulting. She's really a troubled kid.
I used to teach a couple like this. Obviously, if you were a teacher, these girls were just completely uncontrollable. And I can remember my Jess equivalent when I was teaching suddenly producing a cigarette in class and lighting it, and me having this argument with her, which ended with the compromise of her sitting near the window. So the smoke went out of the window, and me feeling at the end of the lesson that I had managed to exercise some kind of control. But she stayed with me a lot, that girl, after I stopped teaching. And one of the reasons I think she stayed with me is she became a kind of metaphor in a way for a creative process, because she makes things happen. And when you write, you just spend all day trying to make things happen and usually failing. But she can start a fight in an empty room. So all you got to do is follow her around and pick up the pieces, which was what I was doing as a teacher, literally, and as a writer, metaphorically. But it's much more fun as a writer.
Okay, the final character who's on the verge of suicide is JJ. He's the American who was in a rock band. The band's fallen apart. He feels like he's never going to get any further and certainly not going to fulfill his dream of being a rock star. What do you relate to about him?
Well, he's the most directly autobiographical in that when I was JJ's age, I thought that was me. I mean, I'd graduated in 1979, and by, I guess, 1989, I hadn't had anything published, and I was drifting in and out of work. And I found it really scary because peers, you know, fellow college graduates were kind of disappearing off into the distance in terms of jobs and careers and family. And I just didn't want to be pathetic and to come back in when I was 40 or 50 and say, no, I really think the next book I write will be the one. And I found it a very frightening time in my life.
Nick Hornby, his new novel is called A Long Way Down. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org. supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Batman Begins. John Powers considers how Michael Jackson's life reflects popular American obsessions. And we continue our conversation with writer Nick Hornby. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the British writer Nick Hornby. His books High Fidelity, About a Boy, and Fever Pitch were adapted into films. His new novel, A Long Way Down, is about four strangers who meet on New Year's Eve on the roof of a 15-story building where they've each gone with the intention of jumping to their deaths. But when they meet, they end up talking and in doing so distract themselves from their plans. One of the four, JJ, is an American who always wanted to be a rock star, but his dream was derailed when his band broke up and his girlfriend left him. Hornby, who feared he'd never make it as a writer, says that JJ is the most autobiographical character in the novel. JJ quotes Oscar Wilde as having once said, "One's real life is so often the life that one does not lead." So, you know, the life you imagine for yourself, the one that seems most real, isn't necessarily what you're living. Is that what you experienced?
Yes, and I think it makes kind of self-immolation more more possible if you think that the time and space you're occupying is not interesting or anything that you want.
Or not even the real life.
Yeah, exactly.
So what are some of the things that you did along the way when you were not living the life that you thought was the life you were supposed to be living?
Well, it was mostly teaching connected. When I quit teaching high school, I stopped to write for a while, and then I drifted back to teaching foreign students. And I ended up with this really cushy job, which was kind of a lifesaver, where I was employed by a Far Eastern electronics giant to teach the guys that worked there English. But in fact, they were so overstretched that we never got around to that. What they wanted me to do was deal with English people on their behalf about the things that were making their lives difficult, which could be anything from getting permission to put signs outside, you know, and having to deal with local councils, to dealing with English dog owners, because the chairman of the company was a big dog collector and they couldn't make these phone calls. And it was kind of a crazy job, and they let me work half the day and paid me decent amount of money. And it actually very smoothly marked a transition between not writing and writing, and I'm sure they're partly responsible for it.
What was the first piece you ever published?
Well, the first thing I ever sold was a short story to the BBC. I ripped off Laurie Moore.
Oh. Which story of hers did you rip off?
I didn't rip off a particular story. It wasn't like I just copied one out, but I was trying to write a story in a Laurie Moore style. And
that's interesting, because people think of you as starting, quote, lad lit, an expression I can't say I like very much.
Well, I think it's meant patronizingly. Mm-hmm. I don't think you'll ever catch anyone saying, hello, I'm a lad lit author. you know, it's meant rudely and it's taken rudely.
Yeah. Well, anyways, I find it interesting that the voice you were emulating when you started to write was the voice of a woman writer. Can you talk about what it was in her voice that you liked?
Well, there were two. There was Anne Tyler and Laurie Moore, who completely turned my life around, really, when I didn't know how or what I wanted to write. And it's the tonal thing with them, that they can be funny and sad, and there's a lot of soul in their work, but Laurie Moore can't resist a pun or a quip. And I was just aware of how she wrote, kind of standing on the balls of her feet, so that she could dive this way or that way. That first collection, which was called Self Help, I think, I just wolfed that down. And she made writing look easy, and I know that it's not. I know that she wouldn't find it easy, and I know that I don't find it easy. But so often we're made to feel, as we're reading, that writing is hard work. And I can't stand reading books like that.
What makes reading hard work?
Yeah, I just... I don't think there's ever been a great book, or one or two exceptions, that most of the really great novels that we think of as being great novels are a pleasure to read. And I would include Dickens and Jane Austen and Huckleberry Finn and The Catcher in the Rye, and all the classics are joyful, I think, and have done a lot of work on behalf of the reader. And I don't think there's any shame in that. But anyway, she was, you know, she was light and quick, but she's extremely bright as well, Laurie Moore. And that was what I wanted. But in terms of the lad lit thing, one of the things with High Fidelity was that I wanted to write a domestic novel. I'd never been particularly turned on by big men writing big men's books. I did read a lot of women's fiction, and I did think, well, there isn't really a male equivalent of this stuff. Men tend to go out and be brave and conquer things.
Updike would be an example of somebody who wrote a lot of, who's written a lot of like domestic.
Yeah, I hadn't read so much of him at the time, but I was reading many more women than men. But a lot of the male novelists were, you know, thriller writers or people who had the big canvas, and certainly somebody like me would have felt intimidated out of that.
You write a column for The Believer, which is a McSweeney's magazine, and you even have a book that collects some of those columns, and the book is called The Polysyllabic Spree, as in the band The Polyphonic Spree. In this column, every column begins with two lists. One is a list of the books you've purchased that month, and the other list is a list of the books that you've actually read that month. Why do you make these lists at the beginning of each column? Why do you want us to know what you've bought as well as what you've read?
I think it's one of the most relevant experiences to reading. I think everyone who reads books knows this feeling, that there's this you know, incredible thing that you're compelled towards a bookshop again and again, and you end up making purchases that you didn't mean to make, and you've got this little pile by your bed, and every single one of these books looks interesting. And then they kind of sit there, and 3 weeks later you look at the pile again, and you can't imagine whatever possessed you to buy any of them. And they start to sort of slowly lose their sheen without you ever having done anything, or even the books having done anything. So, you know, I wanted to point out the randomness, in a way, of what we read, and how you get sidetracked in reading, and maybe, you know, an old book that you see lying around, you suddenly start and you finish that, and then you want to read something else by the same author. So these hardbacks that you've splashed your money out on. In fact, quite often I find the paperbacks are out before I even begin to pick the book up. So I wanted to write about the whole culture of reading.
Johnny Depp has bought the film rights to your new novel, A Long Way Down. And which character is he going to play in it?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, he's talking about being a producer, but if he's mentioned a character, it's the character of Martin, which I think, you know, respect to him, because he's good-looking enough to have played the character of the rock star, but he knows that he's a man over 40. So I think it's interesting that he should look at that one.
Have you, I figure you have, but have you gone to see all of the movie adaptations of
your novels? I've been, I haven't been standoffish. I haven't really been involved, but people have been really nice to me and respectful and inclusive, and they've always wanted me to go and see cuts of movies, and they've wanted me to read drafts. And I actually, it's more a lack of patience rather than a lack of interest. That of course, you know, when the first draft comes, you're really excited to read it, but by the 11th, you really can't remember the difference between this draft and the last draft. And I can remember Stephen Frears when he was making High Fidelity. I'd seen a cut on something like the Monday, and on the Wednesday, I got this phone call, and he was very excited. He said, "You've got to come down. It's a completely different movie." And so, you know, I went down there, and on the way, I'm thinking, "How can it be a different movie? What is it now? You know, this movie about a guy in a whale or what?" And and you watch this movie, and they'd taken out a scene of John Cusack sitting in a car, and I just think these people are crazy, you know, that it's really, really not a different movie. It's exactly the same movie, minus the scene of somebody sitting in a car. But it's that thing that, you know, they sit in an editing suite all day and they can convince themselves that they're making some kind of difference.
You're one of the few people who's not only had two movies made of the same book, Fever Pitch, but
yes,
like from two different countries. There's the British version that has Colin Firth in it. There's the American version with Jimmy Fallon and Drew Barrymore that came out just a few months ago.
Yeah.
So what do you think the differences in the two movies say, if anything, about the differences between England and America, or, you know, the English film industry and Hollywood?
Well, I guess the two big differences, if you see the movies, are the two obvious differences between the film cultures, which is that one was really, really cheap. there was no budget whatsoever. And also, I would say the American one is a lot cuter than the British one.
And is Cuter good or bad?
Well, I think Cuter works and Cuter's fine, but the British one was much more downbeat. The funny thing was about the Fever Pitch remake was that the English movie ends with this great triumph that my football team experienced in 1989, completely against all odds and against the run of play. And the American producers couldn't find a moment that was the equivalent of that. So they decided to make it more downbeat, about a guy that supports a losing baseball team, a perennially losing baseball team. And it was going to be perhaps even a grittier version than in that way than the British movie. But then because they chose the Red Sox and the Red Sox started to win the moment they started shooting, it ended with an even more unlikely triumph than the British version, and with the Red Sox winning the World Series. I joked at the time that it was the only known example of Hollywood taking a small, upbeat British movie and turning it into a large, downbeat American one. And, of course, they found a way of being more upbeat in the end.
The end of the American version of Fever Pitch has one of these just incredibly improbable movie scenes where, like, Drew Barrymore, to prove her love, runs across the baseball field kind of in the middle of a game. And it's, like, not anything that could happen in real life. Did that bother you? Did it seem out of character or out of the tone that you want to just, like, so Hollywood?
I never mind about things like that. I always wish I could think up stuff like that when I'm writing movie scripts, because, you know, one of the problems for me when I do try, and I've been working on movie scripts of my own, but, you know, my characters are all internal, and when they're not being internal, they're sitting around talking. And you have to externalize, you have to make things happen. And I just look at it with some admiration and think, you know, of course it's never going to happen, but that's kind of why we go to the movies a lot of the time.
But part of the reason why we read your books is because your characters tend to overthink everything. And they're thinking, you can read about an internal life when you read about characters who think all the time, and it's one of the ways of getting at internal life, and that's why we read your books.
Yeah, well, I still don't really understand why everyone wants to make movies out of them, because they don't seem cinematic to me, and I can see that there is a pleasure to be had out of that kind of access to somebody's internal life. But the moment someone's bought the movie rights, I think they're sitting there thinking, why the hell did anyone buy this? You know, there's just a guy thinking.
Nick Hornby, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Nick Hornby, his new novel is called A Long Way Down. Coming up, John Powers considers how Michael Jackson's life reflects popular American obsessions. This is Fresh Air. Whatever you might think of the outcome of the Michael Jackson child molestation trial, the story of his life has always been fascinating. Our critic at large, John Powers, has these thoughts on how Jackson reflects American cultural obsessions.
When the Michael Jackson trial finally ended, seemingly the whole world was awaiting the verdict. Even Al Jazeera interrupted its cavalcade of bloody corpses to announce the deposed King of Pop's acquittal. The Jackson case had been, of course, the usual tabloid fiesta. It's the essence of modern media coverage that it milks every drop of prurience from a story, even as it moralizes about it. An entire journalistic code springs from this double helix of hypocrisy. The very cable channels that tirelessly fixated on the case's most salacious details also ran pieces mocking the media circus around it, or bemoaning that the trial was receiving so much more airtime than the, quote, serious news they were ignoring. Although I don't know many people who were interested in the specific details of the trial, most of us would rather not think about child molestation, almost everyone I know is interested in Michael Jackson. And why not? He's a great story. Social Security reform may be important, but it's got a lousy plot. The reconstruction of Iraq is an epic story, but it's so big and complex that you'd have to be smarter than I am to follow the narrative from day to day. Not so Michael Jackson. From his bad plastic surgery to the way he dangles his baby, his whole life has the vivid contours of a train wreck. Even by today's hallucinatory standards of celebrity, Jackson is the motherlode of schadenfreude-inducing follies. Neverland Ranch, oddball marriages, friendship with Liz Taylor, a chimp named Bubbles, that silly glove, the Phantom of the Opera visage, not to mention his taste for sleeping with boys. None of this can be separated from the fact that he's a brilliant musician. If his songs had not been so popular, he would be a different man. He would never have tried so flamboyantly to transcend ordinary categories, black and white, male and female, young and old. Then again, if he'd been more articulately self-conscious about his desire for total personal transformation, he might today be seen as an avant-garde figure, rather than written off as a tragic loon. Nobody was ever this mean about David Bowie. Starting from the childhood stardom that so clearly sent him off the rails, Jackson's story is so rich in poignancy and social meaning that you could spend years plumbing its depths. PhD students, start your engines. Although some like to think him a freak or a Martian, his life is fascinating precisely because he's not. The man in the mirror is actually himself a funhouse mirror, reflecting many popular American obsessions. Take Jackson's relationship to race. In making his skin ever whiter, he took the idea of the crossover artist to a crazy new level. But then again, such racial blurring is not his idea alone. You have to wonder what fantasy today's white suburban teens are chasing when they don hip-hop garb or talk about their cribs. And what about the gloved one's fetishistic interest in boyhood? Ever since the 1950s, our whole culture has worshipped youth. Jackson's obsession with Peter Pan has a special resonance in an era when the age of lost innocence grows ever younger and achievement-mad parents dream of perfecting their children. Speaking of perfection, consider that calamitous plastic surgery. Sure, he looks spectral, but Jackson's desire for total physical transformation, new hair, new skin, new features, is merely an exaggerated riff on the lessons of modern advertising. Jackson's changing look is almost a cautionary tale about modern culture's pressure to perfect one's appearance through gym work, Botox, breast implants, wrinkle removers, penis enhancement surgery, and no-carb dieting. Seeking to craft a brand new physical self, Jackson made himself not only grotesque, but seemed to annihilate his inner essence. In fact, like so many of our fabled artists, Michael Jackson is never more American than in his self-destructive manias. Just as Orson Welles and Elvis Presley expressed one aspect of our national soul, the wedding of astonishing creativity to bloated consumption, so Jackson embodies the great tradition of ill-starred utopianism. He's like the scientist Aylmer in the Hawthorne story, who destroys his wife trying to remove the birthmark that's the one flaw in her beauty. Or like Doom J. Gatsby, who invents a new self to reach a magical future that forever proves elusive. In his attempt to create a perfect new Michael, surrounded by an idealized Neverland reality, Jackson may be many things. A dreamer, a narcissist, maybe even a criminal. But it's worth remembering, he's also one of us.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and the author of Sore Winners. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Batman Begins. This is Fresh Air. Bob Kane's comic book phenomenon Batman has inspired many adaptations, from the 1949 movie serial to the campy 60s TV show to a darker contemporary animated series. The big-budget movie cycle began in 1989 with Tim Burton's Batman starring Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson. Now there's Batman Begins, a new movie directed by Christopher Nolan with Christian Bale as the Dark Knight. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
They call Batman a franchise. It's a word that once meant McDonald's, but has come to mean a series of films, sequels, prequels, spin-offs, plus book and merchandise tie-ins. It's big business, those action figures and lunchboxes and Burger King cross-promotions, and it accounts for the endless procession of superhero movies like Batman Begins. Look, I have nothing against comic books, but I like them as disreputable, under-the-covers adolescent pleasures, and not $100 million movies that dominate public consciousness. Plus, I hate getting angry letters from teenagers who are shocked that I don't know the 287th issue of The Hulk. Batman, at least, is more compelling than other comic superheroes. He's moody, he's twisted, he's self-created. The 1989 Batman, directed by Tim Burton, redefined the comic book genre. The screenwriter, Sam Hamm, made Bruce Wayne a kind of addict, his whole crime-fighting persona the embodiment of a grief at the death of his parents that most grown-ups are finally forced by life to move beyond. Burton created a grand operatic film with gothic sets that captured the lonely, freaky hero's inner world of shadowed arches and gargoyles. But the studio ultimately passed the Batman franchise to director Joel Schumacher, who drove it into the ground in the awful camp fest Batman and Robin. After a decent interval of 8 years, the director Christopher Nolan and his co-screenwriter David S. Goyer have reinvented the series with Batman Begins. The film is nowhere near as emotionally expressive as Burton's Batman, but it's better structured, and its approach is bracingly different. Where Burton's Batman was psychological, Nolan's is socially conscious. Although the 20-something Bruce, played by Christian Bale, is haunted by his parents' death, he's struggling less with inner bats than concepts of justice. When Bruce Wayne is recruited by a lordly, mysterious figure called Ducard, played by Liam Neeson, and trained in the art of ninja warfare, he's also exhorted to lay aside his individual taste for vengeance. Although Wayne parts ways with the vaguely fascist Ducard, he does absorb one lesson, the need for symbolism, for something that takes root in the collective consciousness. Here he explains this to Alfred, his butler, played by Michael Caine, who must be the world's most high-priced help.
Are you coming back to Gotham for long, sir?
As long as it takes. I'm going to show the people of Gotham their city doesn't belong to the criminals and the corrupt.
In the Depression, your father nearly bankrupted Wayne Enterprises combating poverty. He believed that his example could inspire the wealthy of Gotham to save their city.
Did it?
In a way, their murder shocked the wealthy and the powerful into action.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol, as a symbol, I can be incorruptible. I can be everlasting.
What symbol?
Something elemental, something terrifying.
Batman Begins is overlong, but in the second half there's some excellent full-throttle creepiness, especially from Cillian Murphy as a clammy psychiatrist who turns into a low-tech villain, the Scarecrow, with a bag over his head that spews a high-powered hallucinogen. There's some stuff in Batman Begins that doesn't measure up, though. Katie Holmes intones civics lessons as a crusading assistant DA, but she looks and acts like a student council president. Gotham City is mundane, with only an above-ground rail system designed by Bruce's liberal dad to inject an element of otherworldliness. The Batmobile is a bat tank with the sex appeal of a steamroller. Apart from a few tricky flashbacks, there's no indication that Nolan directed the mind-bending Memento or the hallucinatory Insomnia. The most original touch is Bale's Batman. He underplays Bruce Wayne. This guy really internalizes his pain. But Batman is a splendidly ham-bone creation. His voice is a low rasp, and when he talks to people, he cocks his pointy-eared head and looks like a winged creature at rest. In the fight sequences, Nolan barely lets you see the Dark Knight. He comes at the villains from all directions, which drives them out of their minds before they're cold-cocked. It's fun to see a Batman that's still, for Bruce Wayne, a work in progress, still wrestling with the idea of what a superhero should be, still figuring out the franchise.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tuohy-Westman. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by the late pianist and composer Jackie Byard, who was born 83 years ago today. Here's his 1967 recording of St. Louis Blues with David Eisenson on bass, Elvin Jones, drums, and timpani. On the next Fresh Air, the federal deficit, how it got to be so big, what the consequences are, and alternatives for digging out. We talk with economists Isabel Sawhill of the Brookings Institution and Brian Riedel of the Heritage Foundation. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.